Not Sully or Orlean, everybody else. I think there was a couple points that we left over from last week that I don't know if Orlean spoke about in terms of Shivan Akiyam. So you'll correct me if you mention these points very. I just had a couple things here that I would just very quickly mention. If you mention them, please let me know. That proves that I was sleeping then. I was here, but okay. Where did the sheets go? In terms of Shivan Akiyam. So, did you talk about Mokhtachok? Did you mention that? I forgot already. Very briefly. Okay, so if you didn't mention it, in terms of Mokhtachok, again, just review. Mokhtachok is basically a bedika cloth, usually a bedika cloth, though some posts say it could be a tampon, that a woman will check herself with after the Hefsek Tara, again, the night that she's doing her Hefsek Tara to see if she's clean so she can start the Shivan Akiyam. So if the Hefsek Tara is clean, so then the Mokhtachok is, again, usually a bedika cloth, sometimes a tampon, that she basically uses to check in the same area. She puts it in, and she leaves it there for the entire period of Banash Mashos. Okay, the idea, again, I think we mentioned this last week, is simply to make sure that she is 100% clean before she starts with Shivan Akiyam. Again, I still don't remember if you mentioned this, but there's a different opinions about how long Banash Mashos is. Around here, we usually say roughly 20 minutes, depending on who you ask. I think roughly 20 minutes is usually the standard. Did you mention this? I don't remember. I don't think so. Okay, so again, there are different opinions in general. Banash Mashos ranging from 13 minutes to 35, 45, 50 minutes, depending on where you live in the world. Again, here in Eretz Yisrael, I think that 20 minutes is a good standard shear for something, which, again, a moch is not even a halacha d'rabbanan. It's generally, in most cases, is only a chumrah, with some exceptions, but in general, it's only a chumrah. So that's generally, you know, say roughly 20 minutes is good to do that. If the moch comes out problematic, meaning if the hefsek tara was clean and the moch tachuk is not so clean, then again, if you're not sure, definitely show it to a rav. Often be aware that it could be that if that was problematic, there may be some sort of irritation that took place during that time, and therefore the Rav may say, again, don't do this on your own, but the Rav may tell you that the next night you have to do a hefsek for sure to start your Shivan Akiyam, but it could be that he'll recommend doing away with the moch, because if the moch is something which is causing a special, you know, excessive irritation, then that could be something which would not be done. So again, you have to check with that. Again, moch tachuk today is usually just stuck in and put in place. There are questions, again, ask a Rav if this happens, but there are questions if the Hefsek Tara was not clean or you weren't sure about the Hefsek Tara and there was no time to ask a Rav. So it could be that putting in a moch tachuk is a good idea anyway if there's no time. Again, this revolving already spoke about last week, that it's good when you do a Hefsek to leave enough amount of time that if it's not good, you can wait 15 minutes and do another one. But again, let's say that didn't happen. So if you did a Hefsek, comes out, you're not sure what to do with it, there's no time to ask somebody. It could be that there's no time to do another Hefsek. It could be that you can still do a moch and wait and see what happens with the moch. Bring it to the Rav again, you know, let's say the next day. Could be that if the moch is clean, depending on how you did it, and again, you'll have to describe to the Rav how, you know, the woman will have to describe to the Rav, whoever's asking the shayla, of how it was done. If the moch was inserted similar to a bedika, and that it was moved around and rotated in addition to being left there for 20 minutes, it could be that the moch dachal can, you know, bedievit serve as a substitute for the hefsek tara. But again, that's something which should be asked as a shayla. It shouldn't be just assumed one way or the other. In those cases, should be generally asked. And just one last point, and then if anybody has a question or a comment, just the one case to be aware of, that the moch tachuk is more than just a stringency, that maybe actual halacha, according to many poskim, is if she actually sees, let's try that again. If she does a bedika during the Shivan Akiyam, and it turns out the bedika is problematic, and it's reddish, and it turns out that she's coming, she has to start again. So in that case, it could be that the moch tachuk in that situation is actually halacha. Okay, that's, again, without getting into the details of the sugya, but it's a case where she sees, you know, on one day, it could be that's treated like the halacha in the Rishonim, what's called Mayanav Pasuach, which means that her blood is flowing.
So you mean the second time she has to start over?
Yeah, I mean, basically, again, the case would be that, let's say she's doing a bedika, and again, if she sees a stain, this is not necessarily the case, and if you're not sure, again, we don't have time to get into this now, you should ask about this. But if she does a bedika, let's say on the second day of Shivan Akiyam, and it turns out that the bedika is problematic, either she knows right away that it's problematic, or it turns out when she speaks to the Rav, or he speaks to the Rav, that it's problematic. So in that case, many, many poskim say that that the moch tachuk is something which is lechatchila, is absolutely required to be done. Meaning, even though when you normally do it with the hefsek tara in a normal situation, it's appropriate to be done. It's an appropriate chumrah which the Shulchan Aruch brings down from the Rashba. But, you know, it's not an absolute requirement. In this case, where she saw, you know, a one day flow, or perhaps according to many poskim, if she saw on a bedika cloth on that one day, then many posts would say that it's actually required to do the moch tachuk, and you can't really get away with it. Again, if there's special situations like irritation, whatever, then she should ask a shayla. She shouldn't just assume to do it or not to do it. And b'dievet, if she didn't do it, many posts can hold it, b'dievet, it's still okay, that she can still go ahead and do it. And forgot to mention before, and then take a comment, also, the hefsek tara in that situation also should be done in the afternoon. I mean, as opposed to what we said last week, that maker hadin, if you did the hefsek tara in the morning, that may count, l'chachili, you should do it in the afternoon, but if you did it in the morning and you missed the afternoon, then that may be okay for a hefsek tara. But in this case, it was moftachok, where she saw on one day, or she saw a medika cloth on the second day of her shivan akim, so in that situation, it should be, it really should be done in the afternoon. Again, if that was a mouthful, then you can ask me about it afterwards, we can review another time, but just to mention the points, so at least you know that there are some other exceptions there. Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to point out that we're focusing here on the halakhic aspect, that she gets the feedback that it's important to share, that women want only as much help as they need, often. One has to be very careful in this whole issue of, on the one hand, you want to give them the feeling that they are responsible for the shivan akim and for the bidikos and for going to the mikvah. They don't necessarily want you breathing down their back all the time. On the other hand, sometimes they do want help. So a person has to be very sensitive to his life cues, how much help she wants, needs, and how much space she doesn't, may not want you coming and say, did you, sometimes they have a little bit of space. The person has to be very careful. Sensitive knowledge to the halakhic aspect, but also the shalabayas aspect of it, to make sure that the wife gets the support and the help that she needs, but the sense that she has that she is being respected and she's being given the responsibility and being trusted on it.
That's a good point. Nothing that we said is contradicting that. We're just, giving advice. So, or halachic advice, what to do in some of these situations. Again, I think usually the assumption is that if the woman is honest about it and she wants to keep the halacha, then she will discuss with her husband if any of these situations come up, and then they'll decide together what to do, either to ask or not to ask or whatever. But yeah, absolutely, that's not. You definitely have to be careful about it. And if somebody gets a little bit too, back and forth and too questioning, then. Again, she speaks to her Rav, and sometimes that's indication of other questions, but again, we won't go there for now. You spoke about the bedikas for during Shivan Akim, right? Or maybe you didn't speak about it. Twice a day, day one, day seven, all the rest of them. Now you spoke about it, right? Okay, fine. Again, irritation. Just to mention, again, there are some poskim that require, that are not, that don't push two bedikas a day all the time. It could be that one bedika is good enough. That depends on who you ask. It depends on how irritated the area gets. So again, if there are questions, then it's always kedai to seek the advice of a Rav if it seems that it's causing more problems than it's helping. So again, speak to a Rav if she finds that she may be bleeding or that it irritates her or she feels pain during the bedikos. Definitely, many times you can cut down on the standard amounts of bedikos, either how many times a day or the amount of days that it is done. Again, there are other options as well. Again, speak to a Rav, but she may, women already are often familiar with this in terms of options of using, once in a while, using lubricants, maybe not directly on the bedika cloth, but lubricating the area a little bit before doing the bedika cloth, some rabbanim suggest maybe not putting lubricants on the bedika cloth, but sometimes putting a little bit of water, not a lot, just a little bit to make it somewhat a little more moist, again, might be an option. And again, sometimes you can drop some of the bedikos, but that's not something to decide definitely on your own unless you had an absolute psak from some sort of rabbinic figure. More than that, I think that was basically it. In terms of the custom of wearing white, I don't think this we mentioned. So again, the custom I think most people know is to wear white. This is brought down in the Ramah during the Shivan Akim. The idea seems to be that if she wears white, then she'll know if there is blood, and she'll become tummy if she sees that there's blood. So again, if there's spotting, there's questions. So again, speak to second. Undergarments. Okay. There's a question about sheets also. Today, probably sheets are not absolutely required to have white sheets. In those days, maybe it was. And some people have the custom of using white sheets today as well. Again, in terms of spotting, so you have to, again, be careful in terms of spotting. If she has spotting, she should speak to a Rav. There may be some room to be makil. And again, any of the ways that we mentioned before in terms of less bedikos, in terms of other things, it depends on how bad it is. There may be other little tricks that, again, Rabbanim have learned or women have learned over the years that she can do to try to come out with a better result in terms of her bedikas. Again, we don't have time to get into them now. Again, Machon Fu has a whole list of these kinds of tricks. whether you agree with them or not, but there definitely are ideas out there. So she shouldn't feel that it's hopeless. Okay, that's really the main point, that if she finds that there is continuous spotting at times that are not supposed to be spotting, you know, it's not that she should just say, oh, forget it, we're going to start all over again 3 or 4 times. She should really, you know, seek advice to see what can be done about it. Okay. Also, again, some posts in some cases would allow wearing a white pad. Again, it's probably not l'chachiva, but again, the eved, that's something which, again, may be an option that should be discussed with the rav. If the pad is white, but a pad may not be makabel tumah, as we discussed a few weeks ago. So again, that may be an option according to some poskim. So again, should ask a shaila in any of those kinds of situations. In terms of colors, so this I think we're going to hold off on until we get our maras. But one of these weeks, I hope that we'll be able to get some maras. We can discuss a little more about the colors in terms of exactly what's questionable, what's definitely problematic, and what's definitely not problematic, with a few examples. But again, anything which you or your wife are not sure about should be asked. Okay. After a while, you develop a sense of what's definitely okay and what's definitely not okay, but anything which really is any question at all definitely should be asked. Again, people don't mind being asked these questions. They're happy to help. Again, it shouldn't be something which is embarrassing because I'm not going to say Rabbanim are doctors because we heard last night that they're not, but Rabbanim have the same professionality as doctors do. It's not something which should be embarrassing or uncomfortable for anybody as much as possible. And again, you know, there are other options as well. You can ask me anonymously. And my wife also is available at times for certain issues. So again, definitely things should be dealt with, should be discussed if need be. Okay, any questions before we go on to Harchakos? Any other comments or questions in the heads? Okay. All right. Here goes Harchakos. So, yeah. Again? Right, so that. Okay, I'm trying to think where else we could mention that. All right, maybe when we discuss the Maras, maybe we'll discuss that a little more. But again, I think most of you are familiar with this concept. But there is such a thing as a bodeket tara. Okay, here in Eretz Yisrael, we're very lucky to have lots of bodekets. And basically, what these bodekets do is they can examine a woman who has spotting problems or other questions to determine whether there may be some form of a maka. Some sort of cut or something which is not necessarily blood, which is damida. It may be blood which is bleeding coming from some sort of irritation or cut or something else which is halachically not damida. And again, you yourself may not be able to determine that. If you see bleeding, you may suspect that something is going on there. If she sees, I think this we mentioned last week also, if she sees blood on the fourth or fifth day of Shivan Akim, or even at the beginning, if she feels uncomfortable or pain or something, some of these cases, if you go to a rav may have a sense, based on looking at the bedikah cloth or based on hearing the story, that that maybe this is something that can be solved. It's not something you can just say, okay, forget it, start again. It may be that it's worthwhile to go see a bodeket. The bodeket can check her and determine where the blood is coming from, then the bodeket can often do a bedikah herself on the woman when she's there and help to solve the problem. Again, every woman is different. So again, my wife and I have discovered from our experience, and you may discover this as well, some women are not always comfortable going to see bodeket all the time. So I guess as husbands and rabbanim, we have to be sensitive to what the women want and what they don't want. So certainly, in some of these situations, it's strongly advised or recommended or suggested to see a bodeket. It really depends on the actual situation of how many days is it, how many days will she lose out on, and many other factors. Women definitely should be open to seeing a bodeket, but if you find that it's not, I can't do that. I don't want to, and it's going to, as we've already mentioned before, it's going to create more problems than it's going to solve. Again, it's not, you have to evaluate each situation individually, so it's not an absolute that you have to see. Here? When did this happen? Really? Really? Is this recent? As of 2 years ago, I only knew about the one in Beit Chilkiya and maybe Yesodot. Yeah, that's the other one. The Kiryat Malachi one also, and the Beit Chilkiya one, and maybe Yesodot was even a question. Or if Adaya checked her out, meaning she's certified by somebody as some sort of, maybe she's a nurse. But so Machon Pua has a list of bodekas around the country that they publicize. I have not seen her name on that list, but again, if it's recent, then maybe it happened. Or, if she doesn't have to be on the list to be certain, legitimate. So as long as Rav Hadaya, sanctioned it, then. She doesn't have to be certified. As long as he knows that she knows what she's doing, professionally.
He said that. He said that.
Okay. Okay, the Seder, so that's good to know. I don't know her information or anything, but I'm sure we can get it. The Seder. Okay. So let's talk about Harchakos. So what is the Harchakos? So this, unfortunately, for those of you who are learning Daf Yomi, this is the one topic in Nida, which is completely not related at all to Meseches Nida in any, you know, a strong, direct way. So the issues here basically are, some of them are from the Gemara, some of them are post-Gemara, Minog, some of them are post-that. So basically what we'll do, we'll start tonight, I don't know if we'll finish tonight, well, if we can't finish tonight, we'll finish next time, whatever that is, in 2 weeks. But basically the idea behind Harchakos is the following. The idea is that because Hilchos Nida is very serious in that a man who has relations with his wife when she's a Nida is obviously has violated an Isser which can cause a punishment of Karis, that's a very serious thing. So therefore, Chazal and later Poskim have created a system to help us not get anywhere close to the potential of violating that Isser Karis. Okay? Meaning that obviously there's a process starting from, you know, certain kinds of intimate acts, which if not put in check, can lead to more intimate acts, which eventually can lead to having intercourse, which again is the Isser Karis. So therefore, they designed the system where we have multiple levels of things which are prohibited based on, again, halacha or custom, to make sure that the husband and wife do not get to the point where there's even a shiloh that maybe they will get to the Isser Karis. And that's basically the background to this. Again, the Torah that says clearly that there's an Isser Karis. Some of the harchakos, as we'll see, are even more stringent than halachos with another woman, okay? Meaning there are halachos related to negia and other contact and relations and other kinds of interactions with men and women who are not married. In some respects, as we'll see, the halachos of harchakos are actually more stringent than that, mainly because of the fact that a husband and a wife do not have an isser yichud, okay? Meaning that they could be together in the house, they could be together in the bedroom, and therefore, you know, Chazal felt that it was important to institute a system so that even though they are close in terms of their mind and in terms of physical proximity, should make sure that they don't get too close. Okay, so that's where some of these things come from. Okay, we don't have a source sheet here. Anybody have other comments? Other answers? Is there more over there? Okay. So let's look at the following. The second part of source number one. I messed up with the numbers here, but the second part of source number one. So this is a famous Gemara in the Sefer Shabbos. We'll do it quickly. I can't promise we'll translate every single word, but you'll get the idea. Very, very interesting story. Okay, a little bit of a scary story actually. So the Gemara says a ton of Debei Eliyahu. Okay, so the Debei Eliyahu taught. Again, there's a big question: what Debei Eliyahu is it? Debei Eliyahu was the yeshiva or academy of a Tana named Eliyahu, or this had some sort of connection to Eliyahu HaNavi. Okay, there are different opinions about this in general. In this case also, it's actually very interesting to see which one it is. We don't know. But if you look at the rest of the story, again, it's interesting to think about which one it is. Let's see what happens. Ma'aseh b'talmid echad sh'shana harbe v'kara harbe. There was a story with one student, okay, who learned a lot, shana harbe, mishnayos, torah shel alpeh, v'kara harbe, and he read a lot of Tanakh. Okay, great. Beautiful. The shimish talmid echad harbe, and not only did he learn, you know, from the textual Torah, he learned from the walking sefer Torah. He learned from Talmid Chachamim. Umeis b'chatz yamav, and he died halfway through his life. Okay, he died very, very, very young. What happened to him? So look at this. V'haisa ishto no telas tefilav. His wife, she was brave, very brave soul. Okay, she took his tefillin. Umachzaras mivatei knesset uvatei medrash. She walked around with his tefillin to all the shuls and all the batei medrash in the city. Wow, can you imagine? Okay, again, very, very brave woman. V'amalem, she said to all the people, Ksiv b'Torah, it says in the Torah, Kihu chayecha v'orechem echa. The Torah is your life and what lengthens your days. Ba'al ish shana harbe v'kar harbe. My husband learned a lot. Torah shvichtav, Torah shvall peh, shimush talmid chacham harbe. He did a lot of shimush with talmid chachamim. V'nei ma meis b'chaz v'yamav. Why did he die so young? What did he do wrong? V'lo yehadam machzira davar. And nobody answered her anything. Why do you think nobody answered anything? They were smart, right? Why do they know why he died? They're not God. They can't tell exactly why her husband died. But look at this. Pa'amachas nisarachti atzla. But whoever this is, either Eliyahu the Tana or Eliyahu Anavi, says one time I actually stayed with her. I stayed by her in her house. V'aisa masicha kol osam ora. Okay? She was talking the entire time that I was there, meaning she had a lot of problems. Okay, obviously she had a lot of problems. Okay, God forbid there shouldn't be anybody that we know, but if this happened to somebody, for sure everybody else would be, you know, shocked. If somebody who was a serious Torah scholar and, you know, got cut down in the middle of his life, you know, how could something like that happen? It creates a lot of hashkafic philosophical problems. So what did he say? Amar Tzibai said to her, "Biti bimei nidosech mahu etzlech." And my daughter, during the days when you were in Nida, what was he with you? What did you guys do together? What did you not do together? Did you do anything? Amrli chas v'shalom. God forbid, I did nothing wrong. Afilu be'etzbak tadalo nagavi. Even with his little finger, he didn't touch me. What about the days that you were white, meaning the days of the Shiva Nekiyim? Okay, or at least the 7 days, maybe not Shiva Nekiyim, depending on which period this was in history, depending on how that halacha developed, but during the days that she's waiting to become tahor, if it's Shiva Nekiyim, so then what did he do during those days? So she answered, Achol imi, he ate with me, v'shasa imi, he drank with me, v'yashan imi mikir basar, and he slept with me very closely, v'lo also dat al davarach. But don't worry, he never ever had any thoughts of going beyond that. He never had any thoughts of the colloquial language of, you know, baseball language, they talk about hitting a home run, whatever it is. Don't worry, he never thought of that. And I said to her, Baruch HaMakom Shehargo, God be blessed that this man was killed. Shelo Nasa Panam LaTorah, because he didn't give any serious respect to the Torah. How is that? Shehari Amra Torah, because the Torah says, Vel Yishav Minidas Tumas Elo Sikrav, because it says that a person should not come close to a woman when she's in Nida. Okay? What's that? Apparently, he came too close to her. Rav Dimi, when he came from Eretz Yisrael, so he suggested that apparently what happened was that they slept in one bed. That was their problem. Okay? He says the Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef said that there was a sinar, like some sort of a cloth or whatever, I forgot the exact translation, a rag of some sort, that was masik, that was separating him and her together, but nothing more than that. So that's how they understand this concept of him being too close to her, that there wasn't enough of a separation between them. And we'll see shortly that there also may be all the things that he did. He ate together with her, he drank together with her, and what we mentioned before, that he slept together with her. These are all going to be things which the Rishonim are going to say, and the Gemara really takes to mean that harchakos, there have to be distance between a husband and a wife in these different areas. Okay, so this story is very scary. You read this story like, oh my gosh, what was he? This is the kind of story that you don't want to publicize to people when you say, oh, the Torah, you know, the Torah is a very sensitive, and people ask, well, why did God do this? Why did God drown all people in the hurricane? Why did God cause the earthquake? Why did God do this? You know, and you know, we always say, well, you know, well, obviously we don't know what God did. And you read the story in the Gemara, and you'll be like, oh my gosh, what? You don't want to publicize this one. But Lamais, again, in those days, especially if this is Eliyahu HaNavi, so again, we can understand a little bit of where this is coming from, that, you know, even if we would never make such a diagnosis or prognosis for the person dying, but if he knew what he was talking about, so obviously the main message that we need to get from here is that harchakos in general, based on the fact that there's an issur of nida, of kares, have to be taken very, very seriously. Okay, you don't mess around with these types of things. Okay, that's basically one of the major backgrounds for the harchakos here. Okay. There's another source in the Gemara, in source number 3, which also serves as a little bit of a source for some of the harchakos. Just read very, very quickly. Amar Yitzchak bar Chananya, Amar Rav Huna, Kol Melachos Sheisha Osa Labala, Nida Osa Labala. All types of work that a woman does for her husband, a Nida also can do for her husband, chutz, except for Mimzikas HaKos, pouring a cup of wine, which again we'll get back to either tonight or next time. Hatzas Hamika, making the bed. This is already not so practical today because people today don't generally make the bed as nicely as they did back then and without the same amount of care and love and affection. In those days, it was really considered an act of affection to make the spouse's bed. Today, it's, you know, more an issue of, you know, cleanliness or just looking nice, presentable, more than an issue of love and affection. Again, maybe you have more love and affection than I have in my family, could be, but my understanding is that it's not, you know, today, our type of making a bed is not necessarily the same thing as in the times of the Gemara, but if you did it as an act of love and affection, that you want to show your wife how much you love her, so you make her bed just perfectly, that definitely would be included in this. Yes, I'm not telling you. What am I turning the bed?
Folding the sheet down, folding the blanket over.
Like they do in the hotel.
That could be, no, so that's in a Hanami. That may be part of it, meaning in order to make the bed...
Making the bed in a way which is inviting.
Right. Okay, good point. That's, again, Hatzaras Hamita doesn't just mean, like, putting the blanket on. Hatzaras Hamita means a whole experience, okay? It means that you make it in such a way where, you said, it's, you know, it's inviting and it looks really nice and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Harchatzas Panav Yodav Raglov, again, I think we're not going to go there this year, but again, washing hands and feet, which, again, in those days was, I guess, a lot more common than today. Not sure how many of us actually have this today, having spouses or wives wash their husbands' hands and feet for them. I think that most of us today would prefer not to have that type of work done for us. But again, those types of activities were expressions of love and affection in those days. Okay, so we'll leave that aside for now. But again, those are just at least a few more examples there. The Gemara itself actually mentions in terms of harchakos. And then, just to wrap this up, so in source number one, back to Mishnah Shabbos Daf Yud Aleph, the Mishnah says, Kayotu b'lo yochal azavim azavim b'nei hergal avera, that a zav and a zava cannot eat together because of hergal avera, because they may get too close to each other, too much of an intimate act, and that will lead to avera, obviously, to having relations, which a zav and a zava are not allowed to have. So this also, again, becomes a source in the Rishonim for harchakos related to eating, okay? Eating harchakos where they can't eat together, as we'll see shortly, those are based on this concept of the zav and the zava. Again, what we said about the bed is related to the Gemara with Tanan v'Eliyahu. The other harchakos of pouring cups of wine and other stuff is in source number three. In source number two, this is Tosfos quotes a very famous custom from Rashi. This is like one of the most famous harchakos, and this is one of the biggest examples of a chumra that we have for harchakos, where we're more stringent than a husband and another woman who's not his wife. For Rashi, I know Yisrael Lahu should be Pesach miyado liyado, mafteach miyado liyado. Rashi had a custom that he didn't pass keys and other objects from husband to wife. So again, if you take like, you know, chasen and kala classes, this is like the one thing that everybody knows. Oh yeah, passing. You can't pass from one person to the next. They all think it's strange at the beginning, but again, it's very well known that that passing from a husband and wife is not, from husband to wife is not okay, mainly because for a husband and any other woman, it's not considered to be an act of intimacy. For a husband and wife, there could be some intimacy, even though it's indirect in terms of transferring an object from one person to the next. So that's generally, according to Rashi, is not allowed. And again, the Re has a support from a version of the story, which we don't have in our Gemara, but the version of the story that we saw in our Gemara, he has a different version where they talk about bringing a jar of oil, which again, you know, may imply that they had an indirect contact. Again, we're not going to go into the back and forth there. Whatever the story is, the bottom line is that this custom of Rashi is accepted lahalacha, that husband and wife do not pass back and forth. Okay, those are basically the sources that these come from, but as you see, they're different levels, and the halachos that are from the Gemara are going to be more stringent in terms of their application than some of the halachos from the Rishonim, not in terms of a regular standard, but in cases of Shas B'chag, meaning in extreme situations where things are a little more difficult, there may be, again, you have to examine this a little more, but there may be some extra room to be lenient in situations of the minhagim, which again we'll get to shortly tonight or next time. Okay, let's go through the halachos a little more carefully. Yeah. Say again?
What is the status of all those halachos?
So the one halacha that might be deraisa, which you mentioned before, is actual direct contact. Okay, the same way that there's a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban concerning affectionate contact between a man and a woman who's not his wife, who's either married or a different woman who's a nida. So too, for a man and a wife, a husband and a wife, for them to have affectionate contact or even direct contact may be d'oraisa, according to the Rambam, from Losikrahu. Okay, according to the Ramban, it's probably only d'rabbanan. According to the Rambam, that's d'oraisa. Okay, so that's the most severe form of harchakos, is actual direct contact, especially when it's affectionate. And the rest of the harchakos that we mentioned before are a little bit lower level down, either d'rabbanan or minhag. Okay. So let's look at the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, source number four. So before we get into the rest of the halachos, you just look at Sif Aleph here. Actually, we'll go through that. You know, we'll go through them in Kesedar. Chayav Adam Lifrosh Meishto Bimei Tumas Achat Tisparo Tifal. A person has to separate from his wife during the days when she is a nida until she counts Shiv and Akiv and goes to the mikvah. Vafilu Shazaz Man Aruch Velotavol. Even if she waits a long time and doesn't go to the mikvah, Tamid Hi Benita Sa Achat Tifal. She's always a nida until she goes to the mikvah. Okay, it doesn't matter how long it takes for her to go to the mikvah. She, the prohibitions of our chakos are in effect the entire time. And there's some really wacko, crazy stories about some big rabbanim. One I heard about was Moshe Feinstein in Europe, where at certain times when the Russians, I think this is how it went, that the Russians basically would not allow them to use regular mikvos. So when Moshe lived in, I think, Luban was the name of the place that he lived, and he was the rav there. So I think there are stories that when they wouldn't allow him to use the mikvah, that Rav Moshe waited years with, you know, separated from his wife before she could go to a mikvah. And it's just unbelievable, you know, types of temptations. But somebody like that, you know, it was not even a question for him. He did that again. I don't know what anybody else was doing. But again, there are these stories that float around, which hopefully never we never have to, hopefully we'll never have to today. That's what this is, what he was asking for money for? Or?
Yeah, he's part of what he was trying to do. Wow. The house and have the mikvah there. One of the things is the 22-hour train ride to get to the
nearest mikvah. Why do you just go to the river or ocean?
The question is, where are they situated? Meaning, we'll talk about them when we talk about...
They're doing the launch in the river.
Would you say that? That's true. In India, you probably don't want to go... That's probably true, yeah. Other places, the ocean is, you know, a river pretty clean. Number one is clean and not so populated, but in India and other places, in third world countries, you never know what's going on in those areas. You may be spotted, so be careful. We'll talk about that more, maybe, whoever, I think you're doing the one on Tefillah, right, in Chatzitza. So again, just as a hara, I'm sure Roland will mention that, there's a question about, it's not so posh that you can go in the river or ocean, but again, it's something which, when you're in an emergency situation, you can do, but you have to speak to a rav beforehand to make sure you got all the points to make sure that it goes, that it's done properly. Okay. The Shulchan Aruch continues, okay, he can't have fun with her, meaning he can't be in a very playful mood with her in a very lightheaded sense. Okay, this doesn't just mean they can't crack jokes. Okay, some couples, I'm sure, have very witty senses of humor. The Shulchan Aruch is not saying you can't crack jokes. What the Shulchan Aruch is saying is there's a certain type of way of talking from a husband to a wife, which is done in a very intimate sense, okay, which can get especially intimate or especially, I don't know what the good word is, would you say?
Flirting.
Yeah, I guess you call it flirting. Okay, extreme flirting, maybe even regular flirting, depending on how you define flirting. Those types of situations, if it's done, you know, excessively, would be problematic during the time when she's in Ida. Shema yargu lahavera. Maybe, because again, we're afraid that's going to lead to the next step, which leads to the next step, etc., etc. He's allowed to have yichud with her. Once they've already had relations one time, that yichud is not necessarily something which we're afraid of. I'll just mention very briefly that in terms of speech and actions, so Rabbanim, at least in the modern Orthodox community, believe that even though flirting and intimate expressions or discussions are not okay, but just things like saying I love you and other things like that, which hopefully, maybe you'll, are not only said when you're in the midst of a very, very intimate discussion, so those types of expressions may not be so bad. Again, if they're not directly connected to the physical intimacy, then those expressions may be mutter. Again, depending on how they're said and in what context they're said, but it's not, it definitely is not something which we're going to say is usher. Okay, that's definitely not something which you say, you have to avoid that for the entire 12 days or whatever, however much time it is. Rav Vosner in his sefer points out, again, I don't think anybody would have had a question about this, but he points out that bringing flowers home for Shabbos is mutter. Okay, so any action which is similar to that, which is done as a nice gesture, and not necessarily as the most intimate type of expression, would probably be mutter. Okay, let's go to the next point. So we look at Sif Beis. This we already mentioned before. We'll just read it instead. Lo yigabah afilu be'etzvah katan. Okay, you can't touch her even with her little finger. This is what we saw before from Rashi, that the Shulchan Aruch Paskin's like, that you can't stretch out something from your hand to her hand to transfer an object from one to the other. Because we're afraid that maybe they'll come to touch each other, as we said before. And also, throwing things from one to the other. Here, catch! No, can't do that. Okay, in most situations. Why is that not allowed? Probably, again, discussion about this, but probably because, again, throwing something from one person to the next, again, creates some sort of slightly more intimate connection than simply talking or putting something down. Okay, very similar to passing, but even throwing is considered to be something which could be intimate. And again, if you ever play catch one to the other, you can sort of understand where that's coming from. In terms of, just a couple points here very quickly. So just two quick examples. Number one, picking up something together. Okay, let's say you can't get the stroller over, you know, over up the stairs or through the door, or you're moving, and you have a heavy box, and you need two people to do it. So is it mutter for the husband and wife to pick it up together? So again, according to the strict halacha, the answer should be no, because it's like passing. Okay, very, very similar to passing. However, and by the way, sorry, Rav Moshe in his tshuva, I don't know if I quoted it here, but Rav Moshe in his tshuva, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's the tshuva that's quoted in source number 8, but it's not the part of the tshuva that I quoted, okay? Elsewhere, not tshuva, so Rav Moshe still passes that usher. That's usher. He says, once it's been accepted in Klal Yisrael, even situations where it's difficult, he feels are usher. However, Rav Avadi Yosef in the Taras HaBayis, and I've heard this also from some of my Rabbanim at YU, that say that because of the fact that this is a minhag, okay, throwing and passing is not mentioned in the Gemara, it's a minhag only in the times of the Rishonim, there may be room to be lenient, that minhag Yisrael, you know, we say that the Jewish people did not accept upon themselves these types of customs in situations where it would be extremely difficult. And therefore, if there's nobody else around and there's no other way to move the heavy box, when you're moving, or the movers haven't gotten there yet, or whatever it is, they charge per box, and who knows what. Or other situations where it's difficult to pick up something and, you know, you can't get anybody to help. So it may be, there may be room to make on that situation, according to some of those poskim. Again, the case which I guess is not so clear, which personally I would be hesitant about this, but again, you could discuss this. Let's say this happens all the time. You find, like, people are, for example, you're going to the Kotel, okay, and you have a stroller, okay, and you're bumping the stroller down the stairs. And you find, you know, that the wife or the husband, either one of them, is struggling mightily to bump the stroller down the stairs or up the stairs, and you just see that the other one is just standing by, you know, leisurely walking along. Usually it's the wife that's the one that's pushing the stroller up the stairs, and the husband's just standing there, you know, be like, oh, come on, what's wrong with them? You know, why don't they help her already? Give me a break. So again, if it was a situation where they needed both to help, again, is that really a situation where you would say that it's a shasa d'chak that they would be allowed to do that according to the more lenient opinions? I'm not sure. Because in that case, you know, sometimes if you could find somebody else to help you, it could be that even though people might wonder, that may not be enough of a heter to, so yeah, that would for sure be true. That's for sure true, that the man should try to do that. But I don't know what it is. Maybe if you could do that, that's definitely better. If for whatever reason, there's no other option to get somebody else. So then, the man should do it, and maybe there's room to be mekel. Okay. The other example which is discussed here is passing a baby. Is it permitted to pass a baby from one person to the next? Okay. So here, the Pische Tshuva has one cool. I don't know if I'm put it here. Sorry, now the air conditioning is affecting me. The Pische Tshuva has one cool where he wants to say that maybe it's mutter to pass a baby because of the concept of Hilchos Shabbos. Do you have a tissue by any chance? Oh, terrific. So you don't have to shut it off just for me. The tissue is. So the Pische Tshuva has one kulur. He says, well, there's a concept in Hilchos Shabbos of chayno seyas atzmo, that maybe when it comes to carrying something, if you carry something without an eruv, there's a concept that maybe a live human being can be carried seyas atzmo. Who could care less? The chayno seyas atzmo. Okay. The point here is that we don't want to have the husband and wife having an intimate form of contact. And if they carry a baby together or pass a baby, even though, yes, you're passing the baby, but because of the indirect contact which is created, so therefore, we don't really care whether the kid can carry himself or not. So therefore, in that situation... Second? Well, you don't let me finish yet. Hold on. Got to wait for the coolest. You jumped the gun. Hold on. Okay. So that's what many postmen say, okay, which makes sense. The problem is, what do you do instead, okay? You have a baby, and the baby is 1 month old, or 3 months old, or 4 months old, and the husband needs to leave, he needs to go to shul or whatever, and he needs to give the baby to his wife, and a car seat is nowhere to be found, you know, the bed is all the way, you know, upstairs, and who knows where. What are you supposed to do? Let's say you're at a bus stop, okay, most of us here have cars, but let's say you're out somewhere, and, you know, you need to... You pass the baby to your wife. And the option is either pass the baby to your wife or put the baby on the floor or catch, right? Well, he said before that throwing is also not allowed. So what do? You put the baby down. Ask a stranger, here, please take this baby and give it to my wife. All right, so we're not going to take this too far. So luckily there is a kula here, at least of some poskim. Okay, so luckily this happens to be my Rebbe here, and some of our Rebbes. Rabbi Willie from YU has a very, very famous leniency, where he wants to say that a baby who's 3 months old is considered to be a chola. Okay, even if he's older than 3 months old, even if he's a year old. Many poskim say for Hilchos Shabbos, and here also the context would be that if the baby is a chola, okay, a chola she'en bo sakana, you don't mess around with a kid who's sick. Now, even if he's not sick, he's still sick. Okay? He can't do things for himself. He can't be passed for himself. Therefore, in that context, Rabbi Willig says that it's permitted to pass a baby from husband to wife. That's what he says. He says it's mutter. Mutter absolute. Other poskim are not so into that kula. Well, Mice, if you ask me, again, there are different opinions about this. If you ask me, my personal opinion is to use Rabbi Willig's kula when necessary. If it's not necessary, though, simply to pass the baby, when it would be very easy to put the baby down. There's a car seat right there. The changing table is right in front of you. Okay, it doesn't create a lot of difficulty. So personally, because a lot of posts don't necessarily agree with this, I personally would not necessarily recommend relying on it when you have another easy option. But if there's no other option which is very easily available, then for sure the star makes sense, and there's I don't think there's room to rely on it. But again, that particular point depends on who you ask. There are different opinions about it. Okay. Any questions so far?
Just for another example with this shutdown, another example that comes up often is if you're out with your wife somewhere and let's say you have the key.
That's a good one. Thank you. Great. Okay. So what do you do with car keys or wallet or money or stuff like that if you're out? So the answer is, again, probably I don't think that we say that the keys or the wallet is a chola. Okay? You can't use the baby kula in that situation. You have to find a way to do it. Okay, now again, those of us who have been married already for a couple of years, this is the kind of thing you get experience for. Okay, you have to sort of get the hang of it. It's not something, at the beginning, it's a little bit awkward. Okay, and you feel like the entire world is watching you, and you put down your keys over there, look this way, look that way, put it down, run, get it back. You get used to it, okay? Eventually you find a way to make it natural, okay, that you surreptitiously walk this way, put down the keys. You find a way to do it in a way which is very normal. If you have a stroller there, it's very easy to put down something on the stroller and have the wife pick it up. Or, when your kids get a little bit older, so you can do what we do now. Tamima, can you take this and go bring this to mommy over there? They don't get it yet. They're still young enough that they don't have what you're doing, and nobody else would totally understand either. But in this situation, even if it's something which people might notice, the halacha is still pretty clear that you have to be machmir. So you can try for people not to notice, but again, that's not a good enough reason to be matir. Simply because you're afraid that somebody might notice what you're doing. You've got to find a more creative way of doing it. Okay. In terms of throwing, there's one other point. The Pesachei Shuvah discusses this as well. That throwing is usher when you go like this. Okay. In Israel, we play soccer, but for this example, you have to use baseball. Okay. If you're baseball, you're throwing a pitch. Okay. So you throw like that. That's the type of isser that we're talking about when it comes to throwing. Okay. If you're passing a basketball, all right, that's the type of isser that we're talking about in terms of throwing. The Sefer Shuvah says that if you toss it straight up, if you toss it up like that, and then she catches it, that's not considered to be throwing, because the point of intimacy is the force of the throw from you to her. But if you threw it up in the air and then it just comes down, so that already many poskim are make all about that point.
It's much more likely that you're going to touch if you throw it straight up. I mean,
say again?
It sounds much more likely that there's going to be touching about.
No, you can't just go like this. Okay? That's not okay.
You've got to run out of the way.
If you throw it like this, if the main point of it, or let's say you throw it like
this. You do it 10 times, you're going to bump into each other.
Not the phone, right? Yeah. You throw it up like that. That, I think, is considered to be like throwing up. Right? Now, again, there are usually better ways of working on this app than just throwing it up. Okay? That's usually like a really last resort.
Class next week on
All right. Next week will be showing hands-on.
What's important in all of this is to try to plan ahead. Like, if you need to get the keys to, someone's going to drive and another person has the key, you don't wait till you're at the car and then suddenly, everyone's standing around waiting
right.
for you to open the door.
Right, right, right.
And, well, what do you do now?
Right.
You plan ahead, and before you walk out of the house or before you're still at the wedding or whatever it is that you arrange to.
Not sure, I just thought of a wedding example right now that must be on your mind for some reason.
But the thing is to use a little bit of
right.
a little thought of planning ahead avoids many of these uncomfortable situations.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And again, eventually, after a while, you begin to think of that and you can plan ahead. The car example, you can probably just leave the key in the door for a second and then the other person can take it. It's not so hard. But again,
right. The car for right. punching the code. And then
right. Those of you who still have a code in your car, mine's already gone. Again, you find ways to do it. Okay, good. So that's an important point. Foresight is definitely always important. Okay, next one. Let's talk about. Where's my sheet here? Shulchan Aruch, Seif Gimel. All right, this is now the Harchakos in the kitchen or dining room. All right, and this will end up being our last one for tonight. And we'll have to continue this. So the Shulchan Aruch here says the following. This, again, we saw based on the Mishnah Masechet Shavas. He can't eat together with her on the table unless there is some sort of shinoi, some sort of change that we have, what we call a heker. Okay? Some sort of item which can be recognizable as reminding the couple that there is something different here. Okay, the example that he gives here is that something should be separating in between his plate and her plate. He says lechem or kankan, either bread or kankan, which is some sort of glass or container, pitcher, I guess is the right word. Or if each one eats on their own on the table, either if it's food or not food, to separate between him and her so that they'll remember that she's a nida. What's the point? The point is that, again, eating can be an intimate experience. Okay, that's why when people go out, okay, it's been such a long time for us, I remember going out and dating. Okay, I don't know if anybody goes out to eat. Okay, I find, unfortunately, we go out to eat very much, much less than we would like, as a couple. But that's something which, again, if you remember those types of experiences, hopefully you still have them once in a while, it can be an intimate experience, okay, eating together with candlelight or whatever it is. So that's where Chazal understood psychologically that eating together can be something which leads to other things, and therefore they suggested, I mean, required really, that you do something to demonstrate to her and mind the couple that she's in a period of nida, and therefore they can't let this lead to anything else. So as long as you have some sort of reminder, there's something on the table which is not usually there, that's fine. Again, every family is different. What's usual on your table, let me rephrase that. What's not usual on your table may be very usual on my table. Okay, that may depend also on the kids and many other things. You have to be practical about it. Okay, we find them, on somebody's table you'll never find anything other than food. You'll never find, a computer on somebody's table. You'll never find, any type of other a piece of clothing, whatever, on our table, you'll find all sorts of different things, So you have to, again, be practical about exactly what's considered to be common and what's not common.
It seems so unusual to just pick a random item and have any item will be a reminder of a particular thing. I mean,
if I was reminding myself
to come to the shir, I wouldn't say, put an apple on my car.
Well, you could be in your car.
To the shir, you know what I'm saying? It has nothing to
do with the apple. The point is, though, when you eat a meal, when you eat together at the table, so anything which is unusual for the setting, when you see that, it'd be like, wait a second, why is this here? Okay, why is there an invitation?
Was it?
Exactly. That's what I said before. Okay, again, I don't want to embarrass anybody here, and I certainly don't want to embarrass myself, my family. But yeah, depending on where you are and what you have on your table, so there's different things that one may or may not have on their table. You have to, again, we sometimes struggle for something which is unusual, depending on what's going on. Again, you have to find something which, if you see it, you'll stop for a second and say, wait, that doesn't belong there, let me go clean up, And once you do that, wait a second, there's a different reason why that's there. And again, it's because I'd even point this out. Okay, when you start your meal, look at that. You see that over there? Know what that is? Yes, that's my MP3 player, which is not supposed to be getting dirty. It's sitting on the table right now, et cetera, et cetera. Second?
Is this even?
Oh, so that's the question. That's good. So I was just going to mention now, the following thing, and again, this will have to be probably our last thing for tonight. Second here.
Ravelli, if I can just interrupt.
Yeah.
Just the issue of when the kids get older, all the kids are cleaning up the table and they say, hey, this doesn't belong here, and then it's off the table because they're being a little bit meticulous about getting the table prepared. It becomes a little more trickier.
Okay, so before you make your comment, I need to answer Shmuel's question. The answer is that it's actually a machlokas rishonim and machlokas aposkim, whether you need to put a heker on the table if there are other people eating with you, including your children. Okay, so some rishonim, the Rashba says, yes, you need a heker. Other rishonim say, no, you don't need a heker. And other rishonim say, you don't need a heker if they sit in between the two of you. Okay, if they're sitting in between you and your wife, then in that case, there's no heker. Why is that? Well, just think about it for a second. Okay? What if the kids are in between your ankles in the tree? There is no intimate meal, no intimate, nothing. Okay? It's not happening. Okay? Nothing is happening. So that's machlokes poskim. What to do in that situation? Opinions about this. Rabbi Willig felt that there's room to be makel to never have a heker when other people are eating with you. So again, there's different legitimate opinions about that. But certainly the middle approach you could definitely follow. That if they sit in between you, then you can then you don't need the heker. But again, don't forget about it completely. Meaning it is something if it's just you and your wife, you definitely should need. Okay, we'll stop here for tonight, and we'll continue I guess in 2 weeks. Next week is Rabbi Weitzman, I think, right? Whoever is in 2 weeks, we'll try to pick this up. Whoever is going to share. If it's not being used.
What?
If it's not being used.
Yeah.
Okay.